Breaking the Stigma of Addiction.
This is Zach's Life, a story of love, addiction, loss, grief, and recovery.
Reflecting on Zachary Horton
and others in our community, both inside and outside of their addiction.
Hosted by Jim Horton
of the Zachary Horton Foundation.
Hello, everyone. This is Jim, and I'm here today with Roxanne and Danielle. Hello, ladies.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
This is exciting. I feel like Kelly Clarkson, or like I'm, you know, like, hey, I should have TV cameras here now, because you guys are just a blast to be around already. And we're going to, I know we're going to have, this is going to be just an awesome interview today. And you know what? So first, let's just start out and tell everyone how we met.
Okay.
How all three of us met, correct?
Yeah.
Or okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. How did you come to know about the Zachary Horton Foundation?
I came to know about the Zachary Horton Foundation from my time. It was a treatment center I was in last year, and I was at the time living in their sober living house, and I was struggling to pay my rent because I had just gotten a job. I was just establishing foundation in my sobriety. And I was very scared about how to make rent. And somebody that had worked there told me about your foundation and said, if you go on that website, there's an application that you can give them a little bit of information and apply for a scholarship for your rent. So I did that. And within 24 hours, Lynn had already emailed me back. And it was really amazing. And you guys scholarshiped me for 2 months. And then I went ahead and told Danielle about it. And you guys amazingly did the same thing for her.
Yeah, they had, so I was also in my time recovery, and Jim and Lynn, or the Horton Foundation, they would always bring packages to all the sober livings.
Right.
And that's how I like knew about you, but same. Like
Every holiday.
Yeah, we'd get like
even
this
the
package.
Small ones.
It was so awesome. And they're like, you know, those people or that foundation that brings, you know, goodies to our doorsteps. They're like, they will help you if you're struggling. They'll help you scholarship you into sober living, help you get into treatments, whatever. And I was like, okay, you know, it's worth a shot. Like, what else do I have? And so I did the same as Roxanne. I emailed you guys, and within 24 hours, I'm pretty sure Lynn had wrote me back, and she was like, more than happy to help you out here. If there's anything else we can do for you, like, let us know. And that's
well, and that's such an important part of, I think, what our foundation does. And it's certainly, I know Lynn's heart really goes out to that. So she runs all the sober living. I'll deliver stuff every once in a while, but she's the one that puts the packages together and decides what's going to be given out. And so, and the idea is that we want everyone that's in treatment to still feel special, right? And
definitely,
to feel like, and so that's it. So if we can help that way, or just, you know, help anyone in any way, that's one of the main things we like to do. So I am so happy. And that was a year ago, year and a half ago.
It was about a year ago.
Yeah.
It was July, maybe June. Yeah. So about a year ago.
Yeah,
exactly.
So I know. And then I'm going to say, so I remember seeing you at an event we did about a year ago, and then just recently we were at an event and you guys helped out. So you gave back to us and helped invite people in when we did the event at the church.
Oh yes. At First Street Church. where we hold the HA meetings.
Yeah. 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 So that was really cool to see that again and be in touch. And I know we have a Memorial softball game coming up,
yes,
right? And so we're going to be doing some work there, and we have a fireworks stand coming up. And I know that there may be an opportunity, you know, for you guys to
volunteer.
To come out and volunteer there too.
I would love that.
Anyway.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Roxanne and I were going to be the, what do you call it?
Announcers.
Announcers at the softball game.
That's it. That's perfect.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
I don't know. See, you guys are great with the mic. We may not get it out of your hand, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Okay, so cool. So one of you started just, so you know what I'd like for our audience to hear is a little bit about your stories, where you've been, how you got there, where you're at now, and kind of what your dreams are for the future. And then, and along that conversation, then our audience is going to hear some things about what recovery feels like, what kind of pitfalls come around recovery, you know. Anyway, so I'm going to stop there and just turn it over to you. So you guys, Rochambeau, decide who's going to go first. Do you know what it's rock, scissors, paper?
Yeah, yeah. Rochambeau. Okay, I'll go. Okay, I'll Rochambeau. Go.
Rochambeau.
Rochambeau. Okay. Oh, geez. I don't
Who
even know,
are
like,
you?
I. Okay. Hi. My name is Danielle. Danielle McMahon. I don't even know where to start.
Take us back.
I know. Hold on. Okay. So I'll just do like a quick little like preview. So like growing up, it was always me and my little brother and my mom. My dad had left when I was around three. He's never really been part of the picture.
Did you grow up in Fresno,
Clovis?
Oh,
no, I grew up. I grew up in Astoria, Oregon, and I lived there until a year ago, until I moved here.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. And so I grew up and born and raised in Astoria, Oregon, small little tiny town, absolutely. Like you can drive from one part of the town to the other within a matter of, like, I don't know, 7-8 minutes. It's super, super small. So I went to middle school or elementary, middle school, and high school there. Middle school was fine. High school was fine. I started to, like, experiment with drugs and alcohol probably when I was 14, 15 years old. Did drugs and alcohol, like, all throughout high school. I got into hard drugs when I had graduated high school. My boyfriend at the time was using heroin, and I had started doing meth. Did meth for, like, I don't know, four or five years. And I always had, like, I always told myself that I would never, ever touch heroin or anything else because I always saw, like, what it did to people, like, what they would do for it, the type of person it made them become. And I didn't want any of that for myself. But eventually one day, I did do it. And from that day forward up until like 80 days ago, I have been struggling with trying to get clean and keep my clean date and, you know, remain sober. So from the ages of like 18 until now, 26, in and out of rehabs. But I think the first like 3 or 4 rehabs that I went to, I necessarily didn't go for myself. I went because my mom or somebody in my family would like ask me to go, or I had lost my apartment or I had lost my job and I hadn't, you know, didn't really have any other options. I never necessarily went because I full-heartedly wanted to go. And so, yeah, I was like in and out of rehabs up until this year, struggling to get some clean time. I never, ever, like, I would always go into rehab or get out of detox. And like when I was in detox or when I was in rehab, I would always be like, okay, I want to stay clean. But I would never, ever want to like put in any work for it. I would always just think that like taking away the drugs would be the solution to all my problems. I always thought drugs were my problem. And today I've come to realize that, you know, drugs are my solution. That's what I run to in order to fix my problems. And what my actual problem is what's going on inside my head and within myself. And so it's finally, so up until last, I don't know, a year and a half ago, I had gotten asked to so one of my family members, he passed away from an overdose, and the whole entire family was flying down to California to go to the funeral. And I got asked to go, and I was like, okay, I'll somehow figure my shit out, get my shit together, and I'll somehow be able to go to this funeral. And I was doing heroin up until that time, and for some reason, I thought it was a brilliant idea to switch from heroin to fentanyl because I was too scared to bring heroin on a plane with me, and I thought it was a good idea to bring fentanyl. And so I switched from heroin to fentanyl then, and I got asked to go to this funeral, and then I went to the funeral and went there. I was super, super, super loaded. And, you know, like, thankfully enough, my entire family is in recovery. So they know the warning signs. They know what it looks like. They know what's going on. And so when I went to that funeral, after the funeral, they basically had like an intervention for me afterwards. And they were like, Danielle, like, you need help. If we get you this help, and we like scholarship you into this place called My Time Recovery, and we get you into sober living. Like, will you go? And I was like, absolutely, I'll go, but I'm still going to go home. I'm still going to do my thing for a couple of days and I'll come back. And they were like, okay, nobody thought I was going to come back. Right. But that's
why would they?
Exactly. Like, you know, like how, yeah. And so that's exactly what I did. I went home, I packed up my entire apartment at the time. I moved all my stuff back to my mom's house and I flew back down to, I went to Orange County and I went to an inpatient women's program for 30 days. And then I went to My Time. And what's crazy about that is like 3 days after I had moved out of my apartment and like packed up all my stuff and I was already in Orange County, my apartment ended up getting raided and my roommate was looking at 24 months in prison.
Wow.
Yeah. And so when they say everything happens for a reason, you know, everything happens for a fucking reason. I would, you know, I'd be probably in prison right now. So thank God I'm not. But yeah, so I moved to Fresno. I was in My Time Recovery for like nine months. I eventually even became a house manager at one of the sober livings. For like the last month and a half I was there. Yeah.
So let me back up and ask a few questions. Cause there's, so all this time, like you said, when you would go into rehabs and out of rehabs and you would have jobs and you would lose jobs. So it sounds like you were functioning at some level.
Yeah. I was always able to like, I was actually like a preschool teacher in Oregon for the last
year. So
I was always able to like maintain a job, or always if I was to lose one, I could always somehow gather up enough strength to get one again and get my feet back. Could always somehow take care of myself.
Right. So I think that's something that a lot of people don't understand, especially when you know mention that you are a heroin addict.
That
a heroin addict doesn't necessarily have to, you know, the trite thing to say is look like the bum under a bridge, which definitely. The bum under a bridge can be a heroin addict.
Which I've been that person too.
And you've been that
I've
person
been homeless,
too.
Living in a car, having nothing.
And you've been a preschool. And you've been a preschool teacher.
Exactly. All while being strung out.
All while being strung out. And so I think that's important for people. I think when people saw Zach, there was a whole group of people that knew Zach at school that had no idea. He had like two separate lives.
Yeah, totally.
Right. He had his party life, and then he had his life with his friends that he was just a completely different
person. Just because
person.
You look good on the outside doesn't mean you're okay on the inside, or your life is necessarily
right. Right. And that's gotta be such a struggle for you to walk that line as well. Right. How did you feel knowing that you're strung out and yet I'm a preschool teacher and I'm in charge of all these, you know, young lives? Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that there's, you know, guilt and there's all this other stuff, which then just feeds into, right, and just, you know, keeps the whole.
Yeah, it has a lot of like negative feelings, but it also like, at least for me, you know, like being strung out, but also like living this quote unquote adult life. Right.
Right.
It made me believe that I didn't really have a problem.
Right. That's what I was thinking.
That like I was still able to have a job. I was still able to go to work every day. I was still able to do these things, but I would be, you know, doing something else in the bathroom.
Right. Right.
And so it made me believe that like my problem or my addiction wasn't as bad as anybody else's,
right.
but it was, and it is. And I think that addiction has a lot to do with your mental state. And I don't necessarily believe that like just because you have a job or because you have a house or you have all these things that a normal person should have, I think it matters on like what you feel on the inside. And like when I had a job, when I had all of those things, I was still fucking miserable the entire time.
Right.
Even though it looked good to everybody else and I was like putting on this facade, I still went home and was like, I don't want to live this life.
Right.
I was still miserable.
So, and now I want to touch on one other thing that you said that I'm sure there's some people out there that are just shocked.
Yeah.
So you said you made a decision when you came to California, you didn't want to bring heroin. So you decided it just seemed like a good idea. I'm just going to get some fentanyl.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. because the way that, you know, and I think that some of this is part of the scare tactics that we use, you know, back in the 80s, it was the Just Say No campaign, right? And we were all convinced, and when I say we, anyone who didn't use, is that if you smoke marijuana, you'd become that bum under the bridge. There was like, there was no slippery slope that you slid down to. You stepped off just... the, right? And guess what? Every kid who smoked some weed realized that all the adults were lying to them.
Yeah.
Right? Now, we do know, because we do know that people die from fentanyl all the time.
All the time.
Right? I'm thinking, and you tell me you're closer to it in your environment in the HA groups, you know, yes, that you go to. My guess is those are most of the fentanyl overdoses that I hear about are people that didn't know that they were taking something else.
Yeah.
They were smoking weed and said it had been laced with fentanyl. They were drinking lean and it had been laced with fentanyl, right? Or they were taking a pill or so, right?
Because so, it's in everything.
Because it is in everything. But if you're, so the thought though, what's the thought process? Why would you, I know that Zach switched to heroin because it was affordable, yes, relative, yeah, to, yes, getting something that he knew what it was, right? Opana, he knew what that was. He knew how much Opana he could take, mm-hmm, right? Because it was, you know, it was put together by a pharmacy and, you know, and it wasn't a street drug. It was, and so he knew exactly what that was.
Yeah.
When he stepped in the world of heroin, he didn't have any idea what it was, mm-hmm, right? And, yeah, and what it had been cut with and what it was about. So, but it was cheaper, it was affordable. It was something that he had easier access to. Now, isn't that ironic? He had easier, yeah, access to something that was illegal as opposed to something that was it was prescribed to somebody else. So it's still illegal for him, but it was a legally produced drug. Why fentanyl? Is it some of those same characteristics?
So the reason why I switched is because I was an IV user.
Okay.
And so I used IV heroin for, you know, many, many years. And so my thought process was I was too scared to bring a needle and heroin. And so my thought process was fentanyl, the kind of fentanyl I got, it was in the pill form, the M30s, little blue pills,
right,
that we get.
Right.
And so my thought process was like, I can just put those in a Monday through Sunday, you know, pill container, and all it does is look like pills.
And you probably thought also that it was equally as strong as the heroin that you were doing.
Yeah. If I knew it was stronger.
Yes.
I knew that's, yeah, I knew it was stronger. It was going to keep me well longer. It would make me feel better and it would look better, as if someone was to go through, sure, my bags at the airport, they're not going to see,
right,
heroin.
And how does it gauge in price? Is it less expensive, more expensive, the same?
I don't even.
You don't even think about that at the time. That wasn't a consideration. Yours was just portability.
My at the time, mine was portability.
Right.
Yes.
And so people know the M30, that's like a perk 30, yes, right? That's like a Percocet.
Well, it's weird because as you were saying, Zach was using Opanas and then switched to heroin, where for myself, it was very similar because I'm a little older, and 10 years ago, plus those pills, they were Roxy sets, and they were... A type of them was a pill that had an M pressed on them with a 30, and they were a light blue shade, and they were a prescription, you know, a prescribed pill that you would get from the, you know, your doctor or whatever. But as the years have passed now, what they've done is they've taken those pills that look like the prescribed pill from way back when, which are now very hard to come by, actually real, and they've pressed them now with fentanyl and whatever else they put in them. So they're now not the real pill that they used to be. They're these fake pressed.
Right. And so anyway, pills.
Exactly. I just pulled that.
Yeah. I just pulled it up. Anybody out there, if you hear about a pill, you can pull it up on your phone.
Yes.
And just type it in. So the M30s, and actually it's oxycodone.
Yes. But yes, nowadays, if you see one of those, there's about a 99% chance that it is a fentanyl based pill.
Yeah. Yes. Basically. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. And you can still swallow them, smoke them, snort them, however you want to consume them.
Right.
Just like you could with the real ones.
Right.
But they're fentanyl, which is
fentanyl now.
100 times more dangerous.
Right. And so one of the things that we do in our booth, and we handed it out at the church, so along with Narcan and the Narcan training, which can reverse an opioid overdose, is we have the fentanyl testing strips.
Yes.
So if you think that you're... you know, that you've got a hold of some oxycodones or something, and it didn't come out of a, you know, you didn't get it from your pharmacist, then you can test that and find out very quickly that of what.
Used those with heroin. I have used those with meth, and both have tested positive for fentanyl, even methamphetamine. So it's like they really do put it in everything, nowadays.
In everything. So Roxanne, so tell us a little bit. So thank you, Danielle. Yes. And then we're going to get back because there's a point where your stories merge.
They do.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Okay.
Okay. So tell
us about you.
Okay. So I grew up in Southern California, Orange County, a little beach city called Seal Beach. And, you know, I grew up, my parents were divorced. My mom, same thing. My dad was around, but just not as in the picture. And my mom was a single mother waitress. And as I got older, I had no supervision whatsoever. I was like left home alone from, God, like all night. Just, you know, and as you get older, you get, you know, in your teen years, the freedom, it's just like, ooh, what can I do with this time? And so, I started, you know, experimenting with drugs and alcohol. And I did same thing with Danielle. I personally didn't really start messing around with hard drugs till after I was 18. And it's funny because I used to think that people that did heroin did it, like they must hate their lives.
Same.
But it's crazy to think how I used to think that. And just how over time, you know, same situation, an ex-boyfriend of mine introduced me to heroin. And I had done it one time, and then I couldn't get heroin, but I could get those pills. And so I started doing those pills like every single day. And eventually I was a complete functioning addict. I had two jobs, waitressing, being a barista, but every single dollar I made the second I got off work went all to my addiction. Like how I was going to, you know, pay for it, that I have, you know, that's all my life revolved around. And eventually it got to a point where every dollar that I, you know, made was being spent, and it was so much money to get those pills that eventually I switched to heroin. And still the same thing. I was very functional. I had a place to live. I was making money. I had, at this point, three jobs. So I was still very functioning addict. But eventually what happened to me is I lost everything. I lost my apartment. I was living out of a 40-foot storage container. And my income switched to basically just stealing things from stores, from wherever, and fraud. So I would make money, and then I would just be strung out the whole time. And eventually I used to, it's crazy how you think about as well as the things that you do on drugs that you think that you would never do. Because for me personally, I was very deep in my addiction, and out of nowhere, I got pregnant. It wasn't out of nowhere, but it was not something that I expected. However, I was fully on drugs, fully on heroin. And I didn't at the time know what to do. I didn't think that, I felt just like that complete hopelessness. I didn't know what to do. So I tried to get into a program. They ended up denying me. And around 8 months pregnant, I went into the hospital and was like, hey, I don't know what to do. You know, like I'm on heroin, please help me. And long story short, they told me that my water was at a 2, like my water level was at a 2, and that I was going to have to induce and have my baby. So I had my daughter, and she was addicted to heroin. And it's like, I, in that moment, really felt this overwhelming feeling of like, I need to get my shit together, you know? And also during this time, I'm racking up multiple criminal charges because, you know, for me, my addiction leads to like possession charges, to petty theft charges, to just insane amounts of, you know, criminal charges. And I'm sitting there like, how am I going to get clean? I don't know, but I want to figure it out because I just had this beautiful little girl and I want to experience this, right? 3 days after I had my daughter, I found out my mom had passed away from alcoholism. I come from a very long line of addiction. And I believe in my mind at the time, I just said, fuck it. There was no way I could have done it. And I think it was just also an easy excuse. I didn't know how to grieve at that time. I didn't even know how to process feelings at that time. And the best thing that I knew personally how to do was to numb them by using opiates.
Sure, sure.
So I continued to use drugs for 3 years after that. And randomly, it wasn't random, but I got pulled over in a car that's headlights were out. And when I got pulled over, the cops were like, okay, so you have 9 bench warrants and we're taking you in. And for me, the only thing that could stop me from using drugs was going to jail. That was the only thing that was ever going to make me get off drugs or stop using at any point in time was like doing stints in county jail. So when they threw me in jail about a year and a half ago, I was in there coming to terms with the fact there was no family member who was going to bail me out. There was nothing I could have done. I was going to kick cold turkey in jail. And around like day 3, I just had this mental breakdown of like, at the time I was 32 years old, what am I doing with my life? This wasn't supposed to be my life. I never saw this for myself. And I was just done. I was desperate for help. And I called somebody that I knew was the only person that I could reach out to for help. And there he said to me, if you're really serious about getting help, I know a program, My Time Recovery, I can get you a scholarship there. But here's the catch. The second that you step foot outside of that jail, there's going to be an Uber sitting there. If you try to, you know, go anywhere else, don't contact anyone in your family. Don't contact me. We're done with you, pretty much. And it was so hard because at the time I was living with my drug dealer. All of my material possessions, like every clothing item, all of my iPad, my laptop, everything I owned was at that house. So it was like, you either get in this car and you come straight here or you don't and don't contact us. And it was the first time I'd ever done, I guess, the right thing for myself in my life in that moment. And I got into the Uber. I came to Fresno and I started My Time Recovery. And that was in March of last year. And I went through my time. I was court ordered, but that didn't really matter to me because I wanted to be there either way. Yeah. No matter what they told me from the judge, it was either way I was going to treatment. I wanted treatment. I was so desperate. And I eventually, after the 6 months, completed drug court with a gold star and the program. And then yeah, I met Danielle in my time, and that's kind of where we met. And that's a little bit of my story. Yeah.
So there's a couple of things that I noticed that are similar. You both have there was a history of addiction.
Yes. For me, definitely Danielle as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. That lasted. there were moments. After, would you say if the same things had happened to you when you were 18 or 17 and you'd been using for a couple, that you would have made those decisions, or did you need to be at the place where you were?
I would say, I think that for me, I had to go through everything I went through to be as desperate as I was to even accept help. But when I was 18, 19 years old, I wasn't using. I hadn't even been introduced to, you know, hard drugs yet. I was drinking and stuff, but I personally steered away from alcohol because my mom was such a really intense alcoholic that it just kind of scared me and I hated it. But at the same time, I just substituted drugs with alcohol, right, or like, right. You know, vice versa.
So you knew in your mind, I don't want to be an alcoholic.
I knew that in my mind.
I don't want to be any part of that.
Yeah.
But I'm going to do this instead.
Yeah, exactly.
Because
that's so much better, you know? You know? Yeah.
Well, and guess what? That's how teenagers think.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's how. Yeah. Well, and not just teenagers. I mean, there's older adults that think that way. But again, I think as, you know, we often, as adults and as parents, you know, I know before when I would look at other parents who had kids that were struggling with, you know, I think, well, why do they do that? Why wouldn't they just stop? Why wouldn't they, you know, because I think, well, a normal person would realize that's a normal person wouldn't have 9 bench warrants and drive a car with no lights.
Exactly. Very true.
Right?
Yes.
Right? I mean, you hear about that all the time. You know, somebody's running, you know, 500 pounds of cocaine from, you know, and they, you know, and they have a taillight out. It's like, why don't you get a car, rent a car that has good taillights?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Well, yeah. For here's me, drug running 101. Anyone out there?
It was like divine intervention because it wasn't my car. I wasn't driving the car. And I was literally yelling the whole time. I effing hate you. Please don't do this. And within 2 minutes, a cop pulled us over. So I look back at it like everything does happen for a reason, literally, because otherwise I wouldn't be here today. I wouldn't be sitting in this chair. We would have never met.
We would have never met you or your wife.
And there's so many things. So I'm like forever grateful for that. But yeah, it's like when you're in your addiction and you are just in it, you don't feel like there's any other way out. Until maybe you get to a point where you want to accept help. You don't want to live like this anymore. There's so many little things that could make you get to the point of wanting and getting help. But for me personally, I couldn't accept help until I was ready to get help. Right. And unfortunately for me, that meant destroying a large portion of my life.
Yes.
So now you two meet in recovery.
Yes, we did.
Yeah, we met at my
Was it friends at first sight?
Actually, kind of.
Yeah, it really was.
We were in the same, so My Time has like these groups they separate people into. It's like young people, older people, and then like middle-aged. And then, right, it was a mixture. Yes. Our group was a mixture. Yes. And that's what group we were in is
the middle age.
Is the middle-aged group. And you can tell it because you came up to me, correct?
We were in the same group. Well, she got brought to my house. She got dropped off with two other girls at my house, I remember. And the next day, we went to group. They pick us up every morning and take us to group. And we had the same group counselor. And she shared. I was like, you know, once you share, they ask if it's okay to ask questions to the person. And I think I asked Danielle a couple questions. And then after group, you spend most of the entire day at My Time doing treatment. And there was a lunch break. And I remember we just sat down and just started conversing about things that were like similar to each other, things that had happened to us both. And like from there, it just like we just kicked it off.
Yeah, I don't think that. I think from the first day that we started talking, I don't think there's been a day we have not spent together.
That's not true. Wow.
What?
Those 2 weeks we'll get to.
Okay, those 2 weeks. Okay, that's, yeah.
Yes. So eventually, so throughout my sobriety personally, I got a sponsor. You know, I was very desperate. I was riding the wave of desperation. And I got a sponsor. I was doing what, you know, people suggested to do. I got a service commitment. Danielle and I both got a service commitment at our HA meeting. And we made the coffee there. I got a sponsor. I was working some of the steps, but it was taking a long time. And then eventually around 6 months, so like being sober, my sponsor at the time was like, I don't have enough time to walk you through the steps. Like, you should pray on it. And I personally hate that saying sometimes because I'm like, what does that even mean? But like, anyway, so after that, I just kind of said, screw this. I'm not going to have a sponsor, right? But we get to around October of last year, Danielle and I moved out together. We got our own apartment.
Wait, hold on. Okay. Mind you, this whole time I was in My Time in, I had this stint of sobriety. I did not have a sponsor. I was not working the steps because I felt like since I was in treatment programs all day, every single day for the past 8 months, I was in a sober living. I was surrounded by a sober community 24/7. I felt like that was enough. I felt like since I was, you know, in these treatment classes all day, every day, I was living in a sober environment, that I didn't necessarily need to do anything else for my sobriety. But then you move out and you have no...
You have two addicts living in an apartment that are doing absolutely nothing for their recovery.
What could go wrong?
What could go wrong?
One of them, me, voices they want to get high, and the other one is going to go along with it because we have no... You know, we didn't have a phone this week. I mean, we did have people we could call.
We definitely did. We had stopped reaching out. We had stopped going to meetings. Neither of us had sponsors. We weren't doing anything for our recovery.
We thought that we were fine when we convinced ourselves we were fine when we knew we weren't.
That we were the exception.
Yes.
And that we didn't really have a problem.
And that's not how it works.
For us, that's not how it works. Eventually we relapsed. And we relapsed together. And it's funny because we relapsed on heroin and we were like, we're never going to do this again, ever, you know? And then within 2 weeks, personally me, I was like snorting cocaine, and I'm like, which is not my drug of choice. So it's like, that's strange. But, you know, it's like I convinced myself it was just going to be like a one time here, a one time there, which is funny because I don't personally know any opiate addicts that can just do.
And I
one time here.
I know better. I've been doing this in and out of rehabs, relapsing for the last, you know, 6-7 years. So I know that I can't just do it one time. But for some reason, every single time that I've ever relapsed, when I tell myself that I'm going to do it just this one time, I full-heartedly believe that. And I think I believe that because that's what I genuinely want, is I want to be able to do it one time and then stop.
Right.
But I'm an addict and my brain or, you know, whatever is chemically wrong with me, I physically cannot do it one time and then never touch it again.
So how long was your
relapse?
Yes.
It was about 3 months.
We relapsed like a week before Christmas. It was me, her, and then my boyfriend Cameron at the time. We relapsed a week before Christmas, didn't touch it for what, a couple weeks? And then
we started using those M30 pills.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, mid-January, our best friend, her boyfriend Cameron, passed away from an overdose from them. Mm. And it definitely didn't help the situation for us being, you know, it wasn't like something that was like, oh, this, you would think.
You would think
it was going to be the thing that would make us be like, okay, what are we doing? But instead, being addicts, being, I don't know if that's an excuse, but it just fueled us further into it. And it's crazy because during those 3 months, I look at the person next to me and I absolutely love this person. She's my best friend. And the crazy part is when we use drugs, I don't like her at all. I don't like the person that she becomes. I don't like the things that we do. We don't laugh. Our friendship is fulfilled with laughter. There's so much laughter. And when we're using, there's none. And it's sad and depressing. And then you start feeling that complete hopelessness feeling of like, is this all I'm supposed to be?
Like we both are completely different people. But like I became the person to where I was lying. I was stealing from her. It's insane to like think back and like compare myself to like who I am without drugs and who I am with, you know, it's like.
But that goes for me as well.
Yeah,
That you become when you're on drugs versus the people that you are when you're sober. It's just.
Like how quickly your morals change. Insane. Everything changes for you. At least for me, it does.
Polar opposites.
Yes.
It's polar insane. Opposites.
Well, and frankly, I think that's a story with. You know, with most people, you don't have to be an addict to have that experience.
Yeah.
With drugs or alcohol, right? That's not, I mean.
They just make you.
Well, yeah, we know, I mean, you know, any adult that's ever been to a Christmas party sees people, you know, drunk off their ass doing stuff that's like,
Yeah, but.
That's not like them at all.
That's not who that person is.
Yeah, that's true because, you know, when
So I can only imagine that it's exponential.
Yeah.
You know, for you. So do you find that you go when you relapse, do you, and I don't want to spend a lot of time there, but did you find that you found yourself going back to the deepest place that you were before, or you were just on your way there?
I was on the way there. Definitely. I hadn't lost the money. I hadn't lost the job. I hadn't lost the apartment, but I knew what was coming next. And it was all those things. Definitely.
I had lost everything immediately. I just went from like to take my like deepest rock bottom I had ever had. And I was like there, if not further, deeper down because of the situation I was in. My boyfriend had just passed away.
Right. Right.
And I had,
I can't even imagine how, you know, devastating on so many levels.
Yeah. It still is horrible till this, like, I don't, yeah, it's something that I wish nobody ever will have to go through.
So let's transition. So then what was it that brought you back the next time? I guess in some ways I'm thinking to myself, you knew the path.
No, yeah.
I mean, you don't forget, right?
No,
I mean,
every time that you have something. You know what? It's weird because a lot of people, for me personally, I didn't think a relapse was ever going to be a part of my story. I truly believed that, you know? But I think that sometimes people do forget. Or people need to have more experiences to remember how fucking horrible it is out there and right. what happens. And I would say what brought us back is the people that we met in sobriety. Because there were so many people texting me, like, are you okay? People that I barely knew texting me, like, I'm not going to stop bugging you about this. Are you okay? And I will say the fact that Daniel's family is 100% in recovery is one of the main reasons I personally, and I know you as well, did get back to being sober.
Yeah, because I had, after like a few months of us using, I had ended up telling my mom and my family that I was using again. And my mom came down from Oregon to visit me and she brought me over to my cousin's house and they were just like, we can offer you help, you know, like if you want help, it's there, will you take it? And I was like, I'll go fucking anywhere you send me. Like this life that I can't stop living, I don't, like, it's miserable and I want out. And so they sent me back to detox again. And I can't even express to you how grateful I am. Like I don't know what the right word is. Like the fact that my family has the connections they do out here in Fresno in order for me to receive the help that I have received for the last year is something that I will be grateful for the rest of my life, I think. Because I don't think that if my family would have asked me to go to rehab the first time or this last time, I don't think that I would have, because I'm the type of person that, like, when I'm using, I'm too ashamed, mm-hmm. especially right. when I've relapsed again and again.
Right.
I'm too ashamed to even, like, reach out or ask for help because I don't feel like I even deserve the help because I did it to myself.
The guilt has to be just yeah. overwhelming.
Yeah. And so I'm just grateful that they did ask me if I – it's not like they're like, you have to go get help. You know, they're like, if you want help, we'll give it to you and we'll bring you there right now. And I was like, okay, like, absolutely take me out of here, please.
Yeah, so they came and they moved everything out of our apartment of Danielle's. And when they came...
But they moved it out because I didn't know.
Yeah, well, what happened when they came, they said, like, they came, I was at that apartment. And it's funny how we had mentioned earlier, you look sometimes like you're presentable, but you're not. But the other side to that is you think you look great, but really you look horrible.
Yeah, really you look like,
and
yeah.
And that's what was going on with me. And they both, Danielle's mom and cousin, both were like, listen, there's help if you want it. And for me, it was a little different because I have a job. I had a job and I was like, I can't just, you know, get up and leave right now. But eventually, within 2 weeks of her being gone, I had lied and I told my job I was going to my dad's house. Right. And I really went to a detox and I put myself in detox. And when I got out of detox, we reconnected because we hadn't talked. And it was crazy because when I got out of detox, I was like, why am I lying about this? You know? So I called my manager. I called every manager I had. I called the owner of my job, which are all amazing people. And I told them the exact truth, like, hey, I need certain days off for these meetings I go to. And at first they were like, well, you know, we can't do that. We have to be fair with everyone. And I was like, okay, well, listen, this is what's going on with me. I just went to a detox facility for using fentanyl. And if I don't do what I need to do for myself, there's no way I'm going to be a good employee. And I'm blessed. I'm beyond blessed that my managers were like, listen, Roxanne, if you're in treatment, we'll give you whatever you want. And it took such a weight off my shoulder. And so at that point, the second day I got out of detox, I went to an AA meeting with Danielle and I got a sponsor who I don't just say is my sponsor. I call, I talk to, I'm working the steps with. I'm currently still in an outpatient program that I go to 3 days a week, but I put myself in therapy one time a week because for me, like, the steps are amazing. Working with someone is amazing, but also, like, I need some mental health, like, help sometimes. I need to grieve certain things I didn't deal with in my sobriety last time. And that's, I feel like, a portion of what took me out too, is like when you have like horrible feelings inside and like you're not dealing with them, it's going to keep resurfacing. And until you really work on yourself and want to grow, you're not going to get anywhere. And so I'm doing that. And I would also say we're very involved in this, in the community at the moment.
And I think just what you said, where you just said you have to get to a point to where you want to grow.
Yes.
You have to like you can want to grow, you know, you can want to have a better life, or you can want to have all these things, but you have to get to a point to where, at least for me, I do this time around in my sobriety. You know, I have a sponsor. I also do therapy once a week. I just graduated my outpatient program. I hit meetings, you know, 4 if not more times a week. And it's just, you have to like reach a point to where like I have done every other option there is to try and stay sober. I have done it on my own will. I have tried to do it for somebody else. I have tried to do it because my family wanted me to. I have done it and then not done the work. And there's just no other option than like you have to get to a point to where you want
to do everything.
You want, yeah, you want to do it. Like I genuinely want to do it this time. And I want to put in the work. I want a better life. And so I'm willing to do whatever it fucking takes this time around.
And I think that we both know people that are out there that are able to rely on self-will. They don't necessarily go to meetings. They don't have sponsors and they can stay sober. But
I think that comes with the time in sobriety.
Yeah.
Like once you reach a certain amount of years, then you don't necessarily need to hit a meeting all day, every day, you know?
But I have 100% accepted that's not me.
it's not me either. I need
all of the help and I'm willing to do it all. Yes. At this point.
So let me ask this. How can, I hear you saying all the things that you're doing, right? And the thing that sounds like you're doing different this time than before is you're just doing it all.
Yeah.
Yes. You're doing it all the time. And I also hear that there may come a time, months, years down the road where maybe you'll still do it all. Maybe you'll do most of it. Maybe you'll do some of it or whatever. But how can other people support you? Now, I heard you talk about when you relapsed. I mean, it was the group that was there that, definitely, you know, that mm-hmm, helped bring you back. Is there anything they could have done to have prevented that? Is there things that you do with your other friends that you go to meetings with to help them? Or what could your family do? You know, what can people from the outside do to support people that they know that are in recovery?
I think that one thing addicts and alcoholics all do is they isolate, especially when they're using. I think that they tend to pull away from a lot of people.
Or when they're on like the
going the down the slope wrong,
and like yeah, they're path, going to use. They haven't yet, but they away, are.
Yeah. And you stop getting text messages, you stop seeing them at meetings, you stop, you know. So personally for me, I've even in the last week, like I haven't seen a couple people here or there, right? Like I'll reach out just to be like, hey, are you okay? Where are you? Because we stopped going to all of our regular meetings, right? We stopped sending out text messages. We stopped communicating to people. And people started noticing, you know, but for me personally, I think that when you start to see somebody just disappearing slowly, that's when you need to make sure that they're aware that, you know, if they need something, you're here. And that's what I try to do with other people today, because I know that's what I do when I'm like struggling or when I'm about to do something stupid. You won't hear from me as much. And I like to think I'm a very nice, fun, outgoing, easy to talk to person. And when I get very inwards is when
Something's going on, something's wrong. And
and it may not be that you've
even realized it yet.
Yeah. Or that you've started to relapse, but those are just the signs.
Those are, yes.
You're
exactly.
Saying.
Warning signs.
Yeah. Wow, that's incredibly insightful, especially just the thought of that isolation. I know isolation and what we do to ourselves, in depression, in just other facets, when things aren't going well in our lives, and we just don't know how to handle it, and for whatever reason we're not able to reach out, right? I mean, that'd be the easiest thing, and that's. Frankly, that's one advantage that people who have a 12-step program that they're active in, there is always a group that they can go to and that'll be open to hearing whatever their frustration is, right, and what's happening. People on the outside, we don't necessarily have that.
No, yeah.
That's right? Very true, yeah.
Right, and so then so oftentimes, but that oftentimes leads to very destructive behavior.
Definitely.
That we do too. It just looks different.
It does. And it's, you know, there's like, I have little controversies in my head personally about, you know, 12-step meetings and AA and all that stuff, because it's not for everyone, you know, and there are people that are also very intimidated and scared of it.
Yeah, very much.
And there are a lot of people in AA that, you know, there's so many little sayings like principles before personalities and little things like that. But at the end of the day, there are a lot of people in AA that are very judgmental of people who use drugs. And it's unfortunate. It's very unfortunate because it makes people hesitant to even go, right? Where personally, I myself and Danielle is this like this as well. Like, I try to be very opening or, you know, welcoming, I should say, yes, to people and merge little communities I've made, because we go to HA, which is Heroines Anonymous, and it's an open meeting to
anybody and everybody.
Anybody. And it's an amazing meeting because there's nothing discriminated about it. You can talk about whatever you feel like you need to talk about. It doesn't matter what your substance of choice is. It doesn't matter even if you are an alcoholic or not, or an addict. You can still go and participate in the meeting and just talk. And it's unfortunate that there are so many stigmas still to this day in AA, because it's supposed to be this program that's, you know, so helpful and insightful, and it is.
And that's what steers a lot of people away from it, or makes them like get a resentment against it and then never want to go again.
Yes.
And it's just like, that's why we, or like us and our people that we surround ourselves in our community, in our sobriety community, is like, we're trying to do things like this, you know, do the podcast that we're on, or create more HA meetings that are more welcoming to anybody and everybody, and just more meetings like that where there's no like, I don't even know how to, there's no like rules.
Judgment.
There's just
rules
absolutely
are sometimes needed.
Well,
there's no judgment at all.
And I can say, I mean, I think there's some major differences in that, you know, when I attended your HA meeting a few weeks ago, you know, just about everybody was young people, mm-hmm, right?
Yeah.
And I've been to some, you know, AA meetings in the past, and yeah,
older, and there's nothing wrong with
that. No, there's not, but there's generational differences that also come up. And also remember that if someone got their sobriety under a certain platform, mm-hmm, and then that's what they know.
Yep.
Yeah. That's what they know. I really commend both of you though, just in the openness and the insight of saying that, hey, maybe it could be different. Maybe it could be bigger. Maybe it could be more inclusive to other people. And if that's what works, and that, you know, I always say, hey, there's enough addicts to go around.
Yeah,
you
know, so, exactly.
You know, you can find it. There's groups out there, and there's a lot of celebrate recovery groups. Mm-hmm. There's regeneration groups.
Yes. There's refuge recovery, which
there's
is
secular.
Like
I've had people on that talk about secular recovery and. So I mean, and that's what's awesome. Just like there's not one single treatment
that's gonna,
you know,
work
for all of cancer, right? There's a whole bunch of different treatments work,
yeah.
And so we can attack this on a lot of different fronts. But I really love what I hear about how supportive and welcoming your community is, and that is just that's awesome. And I think that gives everybody that's part of that community. It doesn't mean that there's never going to be another relapse inside of your rooms.
All the time.
But they know that everyone there understands and that they love and that they accept. And
it's like, what's horrible about the fentanyl problem today is that so many people are passing away. Right. And it's like,
in our HA home group, I think we average maybe, I don't know, once a month, once every 2 months tops, where we have to have our
celebration of life as a meeting of the week.
Yeah.
And it's very sad, you know, and it's like, I'd rather there be a group, a meeting, something where people can keep coming back to rather than feeling like they can't come back. And like, here's the thing. Going to treatment is one of the hardest things to do. You're scared shitless. The only thing you know has been your addiction. The only thing that you know how to do is get your addiction or whatever your drug of choice is and do that for however long. And just going to treatment, getting help, it's like, that's terrifying. So terrifying.
Staying sober is so difficult because you have to literally like relearn how to do life again. Because you're so used to...
But it's not impossible.
No, it's not impossible at all. It just, it takes work and it takes effort and it takes your willingness, because you're so used to doing life this one way for however many years, you know, and now you have to relearn how to do life without this one thing that made life worth living.
Right.
Or what you lived for was that drug or that drink, and now you have to relearn life without it, and it's hard and it's difficult, but it's so worth it.
It's
so worth it to me.
It's also, a lot of people, they go through, I hate this saying that there's like a pink cloud in sobriety, which is like the concept that when you first get sober, you know, the first few months are going to feel amazing. And then you're going to have this like overwhelming cloud of like, ugh, I feel like shit, life sucks, because you're sober, you're going through the motions of being sober. I feel like you can always have a pink cloud with there be some little like gray holes in it. You know, life's never going to be perfect. You're going to have days where you're not going to feel your best. And you just have to try to stay positive and try to like, another part to it is like, you're relearning how to be on your own. You know, it's like you're finding hobbies that you like. Like, I just joined a book club. Like, you know, but it's like little things like that
you're
are
relearning
just like,
yourself as well.
Exactly.
Well, and in the real world, you know, every function is surrounded, encased in alcohol.
Exactly. Yes.
Only every function. That's
exactly.
All.
Exactly.
Only so, every single.
Only
one.
Every one.
Yeah. And you so, go to the grocery store; it's right there on the shelf. It's like every ad is alcohol, which is like I will say is. This isn't a blessing, but you're not going to necessarily go to the grocery store and see heroin and fentanyl on the shelf, you know?
God.
But I can't imagine necessarily if alcohol was my thing, having to be surrounded by that 24/7. And it just takes strength. And I do believe that addicts and alcoholics are extremely strong, resilient people. But exactly like you were saying, it's like, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's legal, which is even the worst, the harder part about it.
Yeah. So as we wrap things up today, I want to give each of you an opportunity to tell our audience if there's one thought that you want to leave them with. And if it's families out there that are supporting someone in recovery, or if it's someone that you may see tonight in a meeting that you go to, if there's a message of hope that you want to give them, what would that be tonight?
I think mine would be if you, like kind of what Roxanne was saying, if you see or if you even think that somebody is struggling, just reach out. Just literally like reach out to them, because you don't know if your text message or if your call or if your hug to them could literally save their life. So just if you think someone's struggling, and even if they're not, a text message or a hug isn't gonna, you know, that's not a bad thing.
That's right.
So it's either you could save someone's life just by saying hi, like, hi, how are you? I love you. And just everything's going to be okay. So just fucking reach out.
That's beautiful.
That's mine.
I think mine would be, more in a sense for people that are, you know, getting sober, still trying to figure out their groove in this whole situation of sobriety, is that if you go to one AA meeting and you don't like it, it's okay. because there's so many other meetings. There's so many other groups. There's so many fellowships. And for me personally, I think that finding a group of people that are sober, a connection, just like your sober tribe, it's everything.
It's huge.
It's one of the main things that keeps me sober is like the people that I've met in sobriety that I know don't want anything from me but to see me just do well. Yes. Wow. And it's vice versa. And it's just genuine, unconditional love. So I think that if you're not, if you gone to a meeting, you don't like it, just keep coming back. Just keep finding
I've
the
heard
ones.
That before.
Keep coming yeah, back. Yep, know? They say it often.
But just keep on trying to find one that just works for you because eventually one will stick and you'll be like, this is actually kind of cool. I like these people. They're not so weird. This isn't a cult.
Like, this is not a cult. I like this and yeah, I want to come back.
No, yeah. I think sobriety can be a beautiful thing.
If you let it.
If you let it.
Mm-hmm. Roxanne, Danielle, thank you both so much for coming,
Jim,
and sharing today. And yeah, and promise me that we'll do this again.
I'd love to. This was so much fun.
Come to our softball tournament. Listen to us announce all the wonderful people playing.
I love you guys both so much. You're just such a bright light. So thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you for having us. Love it.
And to everyone, as always, find someone today, reach out to them, tell them you love them. I'm Zach's dad.
This has been an episode of Zach's Life. Thank you so much for listening. For more info on our foundation and for addiction resources, visit ZacharyHortonFoundation.org or check us out on Facebook and Instagram. If you have a story to tell and want to be a guest on our podcast, email me directly at jim@ZacharyHortonFoundation.org.